So, today, we're going to be moving in this chapter from our discussion of dreams and the undreamable object to something seemingly more concrete by way of photographs, pictures, images, through the medium of cameras. Eigen calls cameras soul boxes, little machines that capture and display images, all kinds of images. One does not even need words to create these images. Words may only arrive later to describe them, but more likely, words are not needed at all. We often think of images having their own reality, because they do. They offer a wordless pictorial reality. And while imagery itself can create or evoke feelings, words, especially through poetry, can do the same. Words paint their own kind of pictures. Why do I start with this distinction between words and imagery? I want to digress a little bit. You know, I never do that. To D.W. Winnicott. Because Winnicott speaks to this passage I'm about to read in terms of words and imagery. And Winnicott, he thought that there were actually two kinds of children. Kind of a gross generalization. But he said that there are children who reach for words and thought. And then there are other children who reach more for visual, sensual, auditory reality. Eigen calls these types of people, he says they're word people and wordless people. And I'm going to read to you a little bit from Winnicott. Winnicott says, some babies or children specialize in thinking, reaching out for words. Other children specialize in auditory, visual, or sensuous experience, in memories, creative imagination of a hallucinatory kind. And these latter children may not reach out for words. There is no question of the one being normal and the other abnormal, but misunderstandings may occur in debate through the fact that one person talking belongs to the thinking and verbalizing kind, while another belongs to the kind that hallucinates in the visual and auditory field instead of expressing the self in words. Somehow, the word people tend to claim sanity, and those who see visions do not know how to defend their positions when accused of insanity. Logical argument really belongs to the verbalizers. Feelings or a feeling of certainty or truth or realness belong to the others. That's Winnicott. Now some Eigen, who writes, differences in sensibility can lead to value judgments about the worth of others, including opinions and definitions of what is real. One source of rancor between people can be rooted in ways they process experience. One can over or undervalue word, vision, action. Labyrinths of misrecognitions perpetuate themselves in our belief systems. When I read a passage like Winnicott's, I feel we are struggling to develop a democracy of voices, a democracy of sensibilities. Winnicott valorizes modes of experiencing and processing experience that are often felt to be mutually exclusive, at war, as if threads of psychic life tyrannize each other. A dominance model only goes so far. A partnership model, emphasizing co-nourishing, needs more room. There are ways, too, that conflict is part of partnering. to elaborate a little bit. In 1993, and I'm going to elaborate on this, the difference we've been talking about in our last two discussions about the hierarchical model versus more of a symbiotic or co-nourishing model, partnering model. Back in 1993, Eigen wrote a book called The Electrified Tightrope. And here's a little quote from that book. One of the great contributions of modern cultural history is to question the basis of traditional hierarchies, perhaps the very meaning of hierarchy, top, bottom. In psychic realities, double arrows are placed between traditional oppositions. What a relief to be able to flow back and forth between antagonistic currents and not pit one against the other. One can take and learn from each. Each contributes to the growth of self. Without polarities, life would be poorer. But we do not have to be trapped by polarities. Our model is now more paradoxical, dialectical, dialogical, of which conflict is a branch. This leads to explorations of processes that may blow the lid off traditional categories or open boxes to see what's in there, including ways that they interweave and enhance each other. I think we have very exciting journeys ahead if we do not kill each other off with polemics and prejudice. Well, in our chapter this week, we're going to open some boxes to see what's there. And right away, we meet another kind of doubleness that comes from this single image called a photograph. Once again, we're going to look at two things that come out of one, two things within one, another kind of distinction union. Let's call these two things, for now, perception and imagination, which I've at the top of the board. We could equally say image and fantasy. There's so many words we could use. I could even be very politically incorrect and talk about the grandmommy and the granddaddy of this same division, which might be the material and the spiritual, or mother, mater, mother earth, and spirit, breath, psyche, even the breath of God, Ruach Elohim. We could equally use other words like soma and psyche, body and mind, the physical and the non-physical or experiential. Politically incorrect in our era, perhaps, but using binaries, we don't have to be trapped by them. We can use them as tools. We can show their interweaving. Psychosis, on the other hand, is often trapped or traps those in its grip, freezing this fluidity that we are trying to depict here. So, for people in the midst of a psychotic process, discerning the difference between what is, quote, really there and what is their own imaginative overlay or projection can be a perennial struggle. But for those of us who are a little less crazy, this struggle is not so crazy at all. Because, after all, we know that perception itself partly involves imagination. We bring our own backgrounds, fantasies, and projections to every perceptual event. And remember, the philosopher Immanuel Kant told us that we can never really get to or ultimately know the thing in itself. We can never know what is underneath or behind what we perceive, but only how things appear to us in different situations and contexts. and modern physics says something similar. But here in our chapter, Eigen is interested in what can happen when a psychotic process is starting to recover. And he finds cameras in dreams and use of cameras in real life to be a positive sign. And he has several reasons for this. The camera can be a bridge to reality, a way to better test the perceptions of a person through the objective lens of a camera's photographic image. And of course, there are always positive and negative uses of any capacity. Some of the potential positives include a way to capture reality and have it hold still, something to hold on to, and also not feeling so intruded or impinged upon by immediate perception, like many psychotic perceptions can do. And it can be a relief to study a photo over time, watch it change, come back to it, check it. All of this allows one to test their perception when in different states or moods. It's like an anchor point to revisit. Some negative uses of camera images might be more defensive. For instance, to objectify and create distance, even deaden the world, like cataloging images, but images with no insides, only outsides, no inner spirit or life, only detachment and lifeless material reality. And yet, are we ever completely free from our fantasy projections, whether we are psychotic or not? Eigen writes that there is a danger for some people of being trapped between two extremes, flooding on the one hand and detachment on the other. The flooding of psychotic fantasy excesses and a defensive detachment that empties images of feeling and imagination so that they become flat. On page 81 in our chapter, Eigen writes that many recovering psychotics not only dream of cameras, but go through a phase of actual picture taking, as if the camera were, for a time, a bridge back to reality. The camera becomes a way to check what is, and more importantly, what is not there. For the moment, anyway, having an image that is not flooded by, quote, something else, end quote. Eigen continues on page 82, saying that pictures are important because of what does not appear in them. Devils leap out of actual faces, not out of photographs. So what is important in photographs to the individual coming through psychosis is that they present and salvage and affirm aspects of the world as such. As one man confided, quote, "I look at someone in a photo with less fear than I dare in person," end quote. So there is a relative safety in looking at a photograph as well. Also, with the distance in a photograph, it can be positive. For instance, often pictures can let one feel something that one cannot feel when face to face with someone. And then we have the pleasure in the last part of this chapter of a case presentation involving Pam and Marge. But first I want to read a quote on page 85 that has direct relevance, and it goes like this. Eigen says, Psychoanalysis is, among other things, a method of exploration. But it is necessary to reinvent or re-envision psychoanalysis according to the requirements of a particular situation. What is at issue is not simply growth or variation of method, but evolution of psychoanalytic intuition itself. Psychoanalysis is only as alive as a practitioner's intuition in a given predicament. End quote. So this conveys something important, that psychoanalysis and psychotherapy, yes, they have background models that support them. But in the moment, in the consultation room with our clients, we often depend upon our intuition in any given moment, and even more so when we meet predicaments, when we meet intractable moments, when we meet enactments. And this was precisely what happened in the supervision that Marge sought from Eigen. On page 84, Eigen writes that Marge sought supervisory help because she was overwhelmed by her patient's insistence on taking pictures of her. When Marge at first refused, Pam found ways of suddenly whipping at her camera and taking photographs, sometimes on her way out the door or at unexpected moments. Pam was amazing at sensing moments when Marge's guard was down and out came the camera. And Marge's prior supervision tended to intensify the power struggle between her patient, Pam, and herself. Her supervisor had tried to help Marge maintain a formal yet friendly setting that could not permit picture taking, but aimed to focus on Pam's state of mind. That is, all of her ideas and feelings and urges to take Marge's picture and what that was trying to achieve. Marge herself agreed that limit setting was critical for therapy to be effective, yet her sense of helplessness and violation mounted. She lacked the resources to maintain the desired boundaries. And as time went on, Marge actually became afraid of this supervision, because the supervision seemed to make the situation worse. And Marge gradually became aware that her supervision with this person went against some of her most basic feelings for her patient. She felt caught between betraying supervision or betraying her patient. And so we read that it was at this point that Marge found Michael Eigen as another kind of supervisor, and began seeing Eigen about her difficulties with Pam. What's interesting about the way Eigen does supervision is that he stays with areas that feel most alive, meaning most relevant and center stage. And his sense in this case was that violation, Pam's violation in her history, and Marge feeling violated, that violation itself was center stage and most alive. And what he did was, first, he asked Marge to speak from her own sense of violation. And what came of this was that Marge, without quite realizing it, was expecting herself to be like her own analyst and expecting her patients to be like her. But the flash of Pam's camera broke in on this fantasy, and Pam refused to conform. And likewise, Marge felt she was not a very good analyst. And so as they began to explore, Eigen and Marge, what violation meant and felt like and was about, the question of why Pam continued to press Marge and create disturbance with her camera became a burning question. And out of the blue, Eigen says on page 86, "I doubt if Pam could stay with a therapist that she could not violate." And although this seems like a funny statement, in a way, Eigen was trying to normalize this sense of violation for Marge and asked her to simply be with it, to not try to solve it or do anything with it. Well, this took some of the heat off. And we read on page 88 that within a few supervisory sessions, Marge was feeling less tense and worried. Remember, she was practically dreading seeing Pam because she had been so wound up and tied up in knots. And it was a relief for Marge to think that she didn't have to solve this camera situation, this sense of violation. And lowering the pressure to know what to do enabled Marge, in the face of her fears, to see that the bond that she had with Pam was more durable than she thought. She also discovered that, or reminded herself, that therapy is not a finished product. It is a learning experience for both people. It is a journey. And experiencing the journey without judgment, without restriction, without shoulds or ought tos can be beneficial. And because therapy itself challenges both therapist and patient, therapy is a kind of violation. We must stretch and grow, and it's not easy. It's difficult. But violation is a point of mystery and also bottomless. Violation is fathomless. There's too much of it to get to the bottom of it. And it's a mystery because every person's sense of violation, every person's history is somewhat different. What violation means, what it feels like, the trauma that occurred, how it was metabolized, and so on. And of course, all of this gets reenacted in one way or another in the therapy. So instead of trying to get to the, quote, meaning, end quote, of why Pam kept wanting to take pictures of Marge, one day, Eigen said, "Isn't Pam's camera a kind of prosthetic device? A little like an artificial limb? Maybe her camera helps support a part of her mind." And here we see Eigen looking at Pam's camera as a resource, a support, rather than something to be done away with or put restrictions upon. Eigen says he felt that Pam's camera might be trying to make up for some kind of deficit. And in fact, Marge felt this way too, but she had been afraid to trust herself with this. And as the supervision with Eigen proceeded, they discovered some other things. Pam's camera supported her seeing and feeling with another person in a relatively safe and comfortable way. We could think of issues of control and how these were gratified. But also, Pam was starting to share her pictures with Marge, as if to say, "Look at this. Look what I did. Look at my picture. Sharing engagement that made her feel more alive. And I would imagine more safe with Marge, who was now more accepting of her picture taking. And so instead of Pam's camera being seen as defensive, Eigen received the message that taking pictures made Pam feel good. In fact, his deepest intimation was that Pam's taking pictures of Marge was a way of letting in good feelings, a way of even letting in Marge's good feelings to herself. And if we go way back and think analytically to childhood, Eigen says that for moments, Pam's camera may have been functioning like a baby's mouth, tasting Marge, taking Marge into her, beginning to digest Marge, her analyst. Generally speaking, we only want to put good things into our mouths. And let's remember that these two, Marge and Pam, actually liked each other. And Pam kept coming. And so, by taking pictures, Pam began to see something of the goodness of life in Marge's face, and the camera made it safer to connect image with feeling. Taking Marge's picture became a way of affirming the fact of psychic nourishment, a process, of course, that has many twists and turns. And yes, we can think of the momentary control that Pam had over what was inside and outside of her, but Eigen lets us in on a little secret that less important than control was the affirmation that there was something worth breaking the rules for, something that was worth shooting, ingesting, developing. There was something she valued, affirmed, and felt strongly about. Pam herself did not know exactly what she was doing or what was happening, but she valued the special sense within her that egged her on. And what can we say about Marge and her development as a therapist? On page 92, Eigen says, "Sometimes a therapist gets just the patient she needs to enable her to come into her own, to become the therapist she was meant to be." And perhaps Pam was doing this for Marge. Eigen says, quote, "The only thing that could ruin their therapy, I thought, was if Marge lost out to her fears and failed to let herself become the therapist she sensed she could be, the therapist Pam was calling her to become."